Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. Hey, everybody. The American run at the U20 World Cup has come to an end. The boys fell 2-1 to Ecuador. Here to break it down with me is Matt Doyle, senior writer for MLSsoccer.com. Matt, thanks for joining me. How you doing?
Doing all right. I think it's a bittersweet day, but I think more good than bad. Is that how you feel? More good than bad?
Yeah, I feel bad because I think let's go ahead and get into it. Just to step back to 2017, watching us get played off the park by Venezuela, and then get bounced in the quarterfinals that way. That was like, yeah, we don't deserve to be moving on in this tournament, even though it was ultimately a close game. This to me is different. This feels like, you know, had Tab done a few things differently with the lineup, had a couple people had better games, we could have won this game comfortably, you know? And I guess that's, in that sense, I feel bad about it.
Yeah, that's the bittersweet part, right? Because we were good enough to advance. Now, we weren't good enough on the day. Ecuador was a better team on the day, but had some roster decisions been better, and you know, and not just Tabs, but like if Sargent had been there, I think we're having a very different conversation. So it feels like a missed opportunity, but there's like, I'm just trying to be big picture here and say, like, you know, the U.S. getting to the quarterfinals of the World Cup at any age group, still feeling like a missed opportunity is a sign of progress. And I think that's, you know, after it's all said and done, that's what you have to look at with youth World Cups, is like, did these guys look like they could really ball? And they did. You know, a number of these guys look like they're going to translate up to the full international level and the improvements on what we have. And that's the ultimate measure. So as frustrating as it is not to taste the semifinals, it does feel like the future got a lot brighter over the past month.
Yeah, I think I basically share that sentiment. So let's talk about the lineup today. It was, Tab made a switch in goal. He started David Ochoa over Brady Scott, something I've been calling for. And then the back line was the same as it's been for, I don't know, for a while now. Dest, McKenzie, Keita, and Gloucester. Now, why don't you take...
Dest, Richards, Keita, and Gloucester, not McKenzie.
You're right. Yeah, definitely not McKenzie. I misspoke. So why don't you take the midfield? Because I think that's the part where we'll probably end up discussing a lot, the decisions there. It's Durkin, Mendez, Pomacall. How did you feel about that?
But, I mean, we discussed it, you know, for all the listeners out there, Bells and I are part of the U.S. youth soccer dark web, and we have our little group, and we discussed it before the game, and I said something like, we're going to be down 2-0 at halftime. The first goal is going to come off the Ecuador counter after we lose a 50-50 in midfield because of Durkin and Mendez. And then the second goal, we're just going to, you know, tune out right before halftime. And now it wasn't 2-0, but we were down 2-1 at halftime, and the two goals happened kind of exactly as we all foresaw.
Yeah.
Like, Durkin has certain things that he does well. He didn't really get to show them at this tournament other than against Nigeria. But winning 50-50s isn't one of them. And Mendez is one of the worst defensive players I've ever seen for the U.S. youth national teams in any era. And so having those two guys out there in that midfield against a team as good as Ecuador, and nobody's going to mistake Ecuador for 1970s Brazil, but they're, you know, they have a thing that they do very well, which is defend in central midfield and then hit you with pace, especially down the wings. Yeah. It was like, that was the roster mismanagement that we all sort of saw right from the start. We needed a better ball winner in one of those two spots. And if you're going to carry Mendez, who's a luxury player, Again, he didn't show it in this tournament. I think his skill is off the charts in certain ways. If you're going to carry him, you need to have two defensive studs in central midfield, and Durkin is not that. So it was predictable, and it was frustrating, and that's where the game was lost.
Yeah, we were all uneasy about it, and I think a lot of general fans on Twitter were too. They wanted to see Cervania. I wanted to see Cervania at the six. I think you did too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Tons of people on Twitter did as well, because just for that simple reason that Cervania covers more ground and wins more physical battles. Mendez is a special player. Like, he can do things nobody else on this team can do when he's on the ball. But yeah, he definitely needs two defensive studs behind him. And thankfully, Pomacall was that throughout this tournament. You know, Paxton Pomacall has become like a defensive rock, which is wild to me.
Yeah. Wild. It's breathtaking watching him watch, like, and it's not just that like he covers so much ground. It's when he does it. There was like the 87th minute. It was a, you know, potential 3v2 for Ecuador, and Pomacall's tracking all the way back to left back and making a play. Having him out there allows you to do things with the midfield balance. Like, I think that had Tab been a little bit braver with Cervania or Cerrillo, we could be having a very different conversation right now, which brings us back to the frustration aspect of it. We all saw this coming to one degree or another, and God, it was a missed opportunity.
I forget what minute it was, but it sort of manifested itself in breathtaking clarity on the first Ecuador goal. Durkin loses a 50-50 challenge, I don't know, somewhere around the attacking third line in Ecuador's half.
Yep.
So Mendez finds himself one-on-one with Sharkopa, I guess is his name. Jose Adoni, mm-hmm. Kifuentes Carshopa. Sharkopa, and Mendez is defending there is so half-hearted. And I think Mendez's defenders would say, well, he shouldn't have to do that job, right? That's what they would say. He shouldn't be having to run 80 yards to cover.
Yeah.
And okay, maybe, but you know, sometimes you're put in a situation where you have to do the job. He didn't even look like he was acting like he was trying to do the job. And it's a wide open shot. Could David Ochoa have done better on that, do you think?
I think so. It looked like his reaction was a little slow and maybe he was a little bit too deep. But I'm not – if you give a guy a run-up like that and let him have a rip, even from 23 yards, when he goes up for 90, I'm not going to fault the keeper too much. Yeah. That was a goal that happened in and because of the midfield. And it's disappointing. And we're going to get to it later in the show, but we're going to have to talk about like projecting out, what does this mean for guys like Mendez and Durkin? Because the ultimate goal of these tournaments is to figure out who's going to lead the full national team program into, you know, this next, hopefully better era. And it's a hard truth that the game is getting faster and more physical and more athletic, especially in those spots. And luxury players are real luxuries. And it was too much of a luxury to have Mendez today. It just was.
Yeah. Well, it certainly was on that play. And another big problem we were having in the first half, which I guess just to continue on the Mendez tip, my thought is, even when he's on the ball, he needs his teammates to be playing well to a certain extent for him to be getting on the ball and maximizing what he's able to do. And when we mm-hmm. have one of our center backs just passing the ball to the other team repeatedly, it's once again a game state that doesn't suit Alex Mendez. And And Keita was a disaster today. I feel for the kid. I feel for the kid. He's filled in admirably, but he was really bad.
Yeah, he had a tough one today. You know, and it's I don't want to say it came out of nowhere because we all saw his first 70 minutes or 65 minutes against France, but his last 25 minutes in that game, he was so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought and hoped that it would go, you know, he would build off of that and end up having a strong performance, but he didn't. And we weren't able to build out of the back and get any rhythm. You know, he struggled, and I thought Gloucester struggled big time in the first half as well. Mm-hmm. And so that left side ended up getting overrun and pulling the game out of joint. And we were never able to settle into any sort of tempo. Like even against France, we had tempo. And against Ecuador, they just didn't let us do it. Keita definitely has some of the responsibility for that. Gloucester, Durkin, you know, you go on down the line. And it was just a really a couple of guys being overwhelmed and against a really, really good team for the age group who knows exactly what they're all about.
Yeah.
Ecuador are champions of South America. There's a reason why they're wearing that tag for sure.
Yeah. But a frustrating thing though is here we are facing the South American champions, clearly a good team, but when we sort of put it together, we were creating chances. Like I don't know how many clear cut chances Sebastian Soto had, but the one in particular in the first half sticks out to me when right after Weah scores his goal, which is of course comes on a set piece. Chris Richards challenges for a header and it pops up in the air, and then Tim Weah just takes it on the volley and smashes it past the keeper, and it's 1-1. And I'm thinking, all right, game on. We're gonna get back into this. And then I don't know, 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, there's a point where Weah's on the left side and he plays an outside of the boot ball across the six. Do you remember the play I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And it just slides under Soto. Soto can't quite get to it.
Yeah.
He may have been offside anyway. But it just seemed like Soto was just like this much distance away from scoring three or four times today, you know, and he just didn't quite have the quality.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah,
like that chance in particular, because I think he was onside. Because if you looked at it, he appeared to be even with the ball. But like it just slid right under his foot. Didn't like look like he couldn't reach it. Didn't look like he wasn't there. He just wasn't sharp enough. And that's, I mean, to me, that's a function of a lot of minutes, relatively speaking, in a very short amount of time, and maybe the moment being a little bit too big. And this is the next step for the program is in 2021, it'll be, you know, Ricardo Pepi, hopefully, as the number nine, and he'll have probably 6,000 professional minutes.
Yeah.
By that point, that, you know, that's significant, and that's what the larger picture path upgrade has been over this decade. Soto had that chance. It's not a surprise that it came from Weah, who was, I thought, very good today. Sloppy at times, but somebody's got to take chances out there, and he was the one to do it. He had the confidence, and he often had the skill to make stuff happen. You know, like you said, this is a good Ecuador team, and we put them under pressure when we were able to get on the ball and get some rhythm. We were trying to make up for so much lost ground in central midfield that those moments felt really few and far between and kind of snatched at instead of imposed upon them. And the U.S. just didn't have enough talent, enough match winners in those key spots to win the game. In a situation where they're kind of chasing it from the first minute.
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you, would you mind describing the second Ecuador goal? Happened in the 43rd minute?
Yeah, came off a freaking throw-in. Yeah, and this is something that has kind of plagued Tabs teams over the last four cycles, is they're weirdly static in back foot. Defending throw-ins in particular, they haven't ever been great defending set pieces, but off a throw-in, they were just standing there, and they let Ecuador receive the ball very easily in the attacking third. Mm-hmm. And then instead of really working to get pressure to the ball, they just sort of scrambled and held their shape, and it ended up on the foot of Ecuador's, I think it was their number 20, who just rang a shot. It was a screamer off the bar, and they were faster to the rebound. There was some hint of offside, but I thought it was clear right from the bell that the eventual goal scorer was behind the ball when the little cross into the six was played in. Yeah. But, you know, Richards, Keita, and Durkin, the three guys who you can't have be a step slow in a play like that, were all a step slow. And that's the kind of goal that knocks you out of tournaments. And this one, it did. And to have it happen in the last 2 or 3 minutes of the first half, look, they're kids, and they played like it. And the Ecuador players all have a little bit more professional experience, and they're all a little bit older. That's one thing to remember from this team. I think the U.S. were literally the youngest team in the tournament. In this particular competition, that extra 12 months, it matters. And it definitely showed for the U.S. today.
Yeah. 12 months is a really long time when you're 18 or 19. It's like it's 5% of your life.
1/19th of your life. Yeah.
12 months goes by in a flash now, kids.
Yeah, it does. Yes, it does.
So let's talk about halftime changes. I guess there was just one. Tab brought on Ulianes for Conrad De La Fuente. How did you feel about that choice?
I thought it was the right choice. It's what I wanted to see. Uli had been a difference maker coming in his previous couple of times, more in the middle of the second half. But it was clear that De La Fuente had whatever spark he had shown earlier in the tournament, he had kind of lost it by this game. And he just, he puts his head down and he just goes. And he ends up going down every blind alley, and he ends up taking too many touches at most times. And he has no left foot. And when you've been scouted for a few games, teams figure that out. And I thought Ecuador did just a very nice and professional job of shepherding him away from goal every single time. And so there was no combination play.
Yeah.
And the worst thing was that when he was pushed up that high, usually Dest is right there as well, because the idea is to have that combination play on the right side. And I think the goal against Ukraine is the best example of it.
Right.
And that was the one time it really came off in this tournament, but like, that's the ideal. But in this one, it wasn't coming off. And then that was compounded by De La Fuente losing the ball. And even 100 yards from goal, if you lose the ball against this Ecuador team, it's a counterattacking chance. And I'm pretty sure that the 50-50 that Durkin lost that led to the opening goal came from failed combination play via De La Fuente and everyone else on that right side.
Right.
The U.S. out of balance and then just not able to slow it down. So I thought bringing Yanez on was the right call. And for the first 20 minutes of the second half, Yanez was a difference maker. Soto's best chance in the second half came from Yanez doing a little bit of clever interplay at the top of the box. He was able to get around the Ecuadorian right back a number of times. Mm-hmm. But like De La Fuente, he's a kid. And he, you know, Yanez was hurt, I think, for a good portion of the year. And he didn't, he didn't play real games. And that lack of match sharpness showed, I think, more in his decision-making than anything else. Because anytime he got into the final third, he was going to take not just one extra touch. He was going to try to take three or four. Anytime he had the Ecuadorian back line beat, because of those extra touches, he allowed them back into the play. And when you do that against a good team, they usually make the play defensively. And that's what you know, that's what Ecuador did. We needed a little more cutting edge. We needed a little more savvy, and the kids just didn't quite have it.
Nope. Yeah. He had that pass for Soto where Soto took a touch that took him a little wide, and then his shot went off the outside of the net, the outside side netting.
Yeah, you were kinder to Soto on that than I was. What was your take on that?
I just think that's a tough. I think it was a pass that was hit with a lot of pace and a little bit behind Soto, so it'd have been really difficult for him to get his hips around and strike it first time. Either with his right foot, and then for him to strike it with his left foot, he would have had to like take a jump backwards and let it a fast pass right across his body and then hit it with his left foot. So he elected to do neither, and he took a touch with his right foot that took him a little wide, and you know, he might have been able to poke it past the keeper outside the keeper's outstretched hands, but probably mm-hmm. not. And of course he was not able to. So I don't completely absolve him of blame. I just think that's a really tough. It's a really tough chance to finish. What was your take?
I think if he had a left foot, he would have finished it. That's one that Sargent puts away. That's one that if you're going to be a Bundesliga goal scorer, you use your left foot and you create enough separation to put that one away. It wasn't a tap in, right? It wasn't a sitter. It's a tough goal. But, if you're going to be a guy who's maybe moving to Borussia Dortmund, if you want to play, you have to score that goal. It was right there for him. And again, just maybe a little bit of lack of game sharpness and a little bit of savvy was missing. And that was that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we can agree to disagree on the degree of culpability, but I agree that Soto, you know, if you add up all of the chances that Soto had in this game or all the touches he had in the box, should have probably put one away. I noticed, but back to Giannis for a second. The other sort of really dangerous moment he produced was the shot he took that went just wide, you know, just stepped by a guy in the left channel and then had a rip.
Yeah,
and he had the keeper beat, man. If it had just been 2 feet to the left, that game is 2-2. So that was a bummer that it wasn't on frame.
Yeah, he actually had two of those.
Did he?
I think the first one was a little closer than the second one, but I mean, there's no doubt he's a talent. You see his ability to beat guys off the dribble, to create separation, and at times to really use it, it was impressive. And the other thing that was impressive about him was his will. And this is maybe a stupid way of putting it, but he didn't shrink from the moment. Mm-hmm. He got out there and he wanted to get the ball and he wanted to change the game. And you know, all these things that you have to have technically, tactically, physically, to make it as a top flight professional, like it's all necessary, but so is the mentality and the, you know, the sort of fire in the eyes, to use a Britishism type of cliche. You need to have that.
Yeah.
And to my eye, Giannis has that. Now, obviously they need to polish him up. He needs to take fewer touches. He needs to make his decisions quicker. I think the play that led to the corner that the U.S. scored off of came off of like a really clever early cross from Gloucester. And that was like, yeah. I sat up and I took notice of that. And that is like, that does not ever occur to Giannis, to get the ball off his foot early, to make the professional play. But that's, you know, he just turned 18. So hopefully they're able to take him and turn him into a guy who makes those types of plays, in addition to the like the slick, saucy 1v1 stuff that he has. And from the outside looking in, I don't know the kid at all, but just from watching him play, he seems to have that sort of mentality where he wants to make those plays and he wants to do what it takes to win.
Yeah.
He passes the eye test on that level for me, and that's important. And, you know, when you put it in stark contrast to someone like Mendez, who just doesn't.
Well, I will say about Giannis, he did play, like his second touch against Qatar was a delightful early ball, similar to that one. But I do think he's similar to the one Gloucester hit today. But I do think he's sort of came into this tournament, and this is just me speculating, but I'm thinking he's out there beating people 1v1 over and over again, and he's like, wait a second, I can do this. And he maybe got a little carried away towards the last half hour of the game today, you know?
Yeah.
I got to do something. I can do it. And then, you know, he has like three or four instances of taking an extra touch or two, but I agree with you.
It was like, hero ball.
Yeah. It was a little hero ball. I forgive him because he made stuff happen. I mean, he was definitely an upgrade over Conrad De La Fuente in every game
for
that he came in.
For sure.
Well, the rest of the second half, we didn't. You know, Ledesma came on pretty late for Mendez.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to see that earlier, that sub earlier, to give Ledesma more of a chance to have an impact on the game. I think you share that opinion, right?
Yeah, for sure. He came on about the 75th,
yeah.
And I would have had him on at the 50. I would have had him on at the 55th. And I know there were fitness concerns. And if you look back to the game against France, he was basically out of gas by the 35th minute. But I mean, Mendez
was also
out of
gas
at halftime.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I really wanted to see that, especially because at that point in the second half, Ecuador hadn't totally gone into a shell yet. They were allowing you to play. And if you do that against Giannis, he can beat a guy off the dribble and bring more players to him, which would have broken Ecuador's shape a little bit. Like, and they were there for the taking. I think I might have tweeted that around the 65th minute. Like, Ecuador was absolutely there for the taking, but we weren't aggressive enough with our subs. So I think, honestly, I think Giannis 10, 15 minutes earlier would have made a big difference.
You mean Ledesma, right?
For the U.S. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Ledesma 15, 20 minutes earlier would have made a big difference, because we would have just, there would have just been a little bit more activity in central midfield, and they would have had to compress a little bit more, and that could have opened things up for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people on Twitter were saying the same thing. See, maybe we're just in a total echo chamber where we all sort of agree with each other on some basic things. Let's see. Should we just, I mean, Ecuador just kind of saw the game out at that point. Once Ledesma came on, they were kind of in their shell. Did you see anything else in the second half that you thought was remarkable?
Not really. You know, it was, I thought Durkin had a better second half, but still not good. You know, Richards is a stud. Mm-hmm. I thought Dest had a very good game. He was certainly a lot better in the group stages than the knockout rounds than he was in the group stages. But everybody, by the final 10 minutes or so, everybody kind of looked out of gas. And we never, even though we were throwing numbers forward, it never felt like, oh, the equalizer's inevitable. We just didn't have that against a team that was this good. There was nothing. There was no point where I was on the edge of my seat screaming at the TV because it felt like it was coming. It just never got there.
No. I would say the last time it felt close was the Soto miss that we described in excruciating detail. And then after that, it felt less and less likely that we would equalize, to be honest. All right. So big picture, where everybody's talking about this stuff, who's your favorite, who's your most likely USMNT regular from this roster?
I would put Weah right there right now if I could. Mm-hmm. Like, if I could transport Weah to the Gold Cup team, I would do that in a second. And I imagine just about everybody who's watched the U.S. Would do the same. And I think I would do the same with Pomacall. He's, you know, he's not a magician number 10, but he's the type of guy where if you put him in that spot, you end up with more you end up with more chances just as a unit, as a team, because he's making so many defensive plays from that spot that are unexpected, that are transition opportunities. I would take him over Roldan. I would take him over probably Dwayne Holmes, though I guess I need to see more of him, your favorite player. I would take him. His ability to make those plays, not just tracking back, but in the attacking third, puts him there. And then my real hope is over the next, 8 months or 10 months or a year, Ledesma, Gloucester, and Richards all become like fully blooded professional players. And it's with Ledesma and Richards, just sheer upside. I think Richards is, if you did it in a vacuum and you asked scouts from around the world, who's the best prospect on the U.S. national team or U.S. U-20 national team, 95% would say Richards.
Yeah, he's been Ledesma, outstanding. He's been so effing good. Yeah.
But the question is, like, he's playing in the third level of Germany probably next year. Is that going to help him? I don't think so. So I do worry about that. And with Ledesma, he didn't really get to show it because he basically hasn't played in a year and been injured. But that goal he made against France, good God, that was special. And we, his upside and the need that we have for a player who can make that kind of magic as a number 10. Now, he's not going to bring the same type of defensive presence that Pomacall does.
No.
But he's a better creator. He's a more pure attacking player. And you could put him in there and then potentially have Pomacall or Adams or McKenney, some combination of those guys around him as well. That is what I'm focused on for the years to come. And then Gloucester at left back. Like, that's, I don't think his upside is as high as guys like Richards or Ledesma or Pomacall, but he just looks really good and solid and smart. And we could use that.
Yeah.
We could really, really use that at left back. So those are the five that I have the highest hopes for, both in the short and long term.
Okay, yeah. I mean, on your point about it'd be nice to just have some smartness and steadiness at left back. You feel like Gloucester could play the left back in this current system that Berhalter has, where it's kind of a center back, left back hybrid deal?
Yeah, the funny thing coming into this tournament was the knock on Gloucester was that he didn't really present much on the overlap.
Yeah.
That he was kind of too much of a throwback, too much of a old fashioned left back who was just there to kind of defend first and foremost and not get forward. And then, we saw him get forward pretty spectacularly at times, including against Nigeria. And now it's like, okay, well, what do we have? Is he actually a modern two-way left back? Which is my way of saying that, yeah, I think, projecting out, he does seem to have the makeup of a guy who can do the job in the way that Berhalter seems to want it done at this point in time. But as with Ledesma, as with Richard, he's got to win a job. Mm-hmm. He's got to be a professional soccer player. And there's talk of him, just like with Soto, there's talk of him leaving Hanover.
Don't leave Hanover, guys. Don't leave Hanover. Stay
right?
there.
Right? Like, I want them both to get paid, because you could step off a curve wrong and your career ends and they only have a finite amount of time to make as much money as possible. I want that for them. But for the U.S. national team, I want Gloucester and Soto to get like 2,000 minutes in the two Bundesliga next year, because I think they're good enough and I think it would help them immediately. And right now, as much as I like them both, neither is good enough to be a regular starting player in the full Bundesliga. They're just not there yet. So please spend a year in the two Bundesliga, then move.
Yeah. I mean, you could imagine Gloucester breaking in and getting some minutes for a mid-table Bundesliga side. I'm not saying it's likely, but it seems within the realm of possibility. I don't see Soto playing striker for Dortmund.
No.
Probably ever, but definitely not next year. So that, I hope those rumors are just agent hype.
Yeah, I hope so as well. But let me ask you, because you have opinions on these guys as well. The five guys I mentioned, I think you're probably in on. Who else do you see as someone for the immediate or long-term future?
I'm a little more cautious on Weah and Pomacall than you. I think, yes, Weah was a game changer for this team, but he was not good for big stretches of the tournament. I get pilloried on all the chat boards for saying that, but I'm gonna stand by it. There were like big stretches of this tournament where he wasn't good. He wasn't decisive enough. He wasn't clean enough. He was cutting in on his right foot, and teams had scouted that, and they knew they could basically write off the whole the whole right side of their defense because they knew he wasn't going to go left and try to pull it back from the end line. So I think he's still I think there's still some question marks with Weah, but obviously he rose to the occasion in several big moments, got us back into this game with a moment of individual class. And I do think he's better. I think he's probably better than all of our wing options, except Christian Pulisic, who's not playing on the wing, and maybe maybe Tyler Boyd is better. I don't know. I think Weah is better than Paul Ariola. So,
I mean, he's more talented. He's
yeah.
not as, and it goes to what you were saying. Like I thought a pretty bad group stage, but I don't think it's because he is bad. I think it's because he was playing with just like too much arrogance, too
Maybe so.
much, right? Like it was a little bit like I'm the best player at this level, and you want to have some of that. You want every guy out there to think that they're, the best player, but you have to do it within a team scheme, and he didn't for the first three games, but I thought for these last two, he absolutely did. And from, we've all seen Tim Weah a ton, what with the full national team, the 17s, and over the course of this year, I think he got 700 minutes or something like that. So we've all seen him, and I think that's who Weah is. I don't think he's inherently a selfish player. I thought he was just the biggest name on the team for the group stage, and maybe it went to his head for 270 minutes, but these last 180. I would take that Tim Weah, even with a little, a couple of unnecessary turnovers and a couple of bad touches. I would take that Tim Weah any day of the week for the US.
Okay, yeah, I agree. And on Pomacall, strangely enough, his defensive work is his like top selling point for me right now. He and I've said this before, but watching him last summer with FC Dallas when he would get a 10-minute cameo and just kind of flop around on the ground for, 7 of those 10 minutes, it's amazing how he's changed as a player. That he now looks more like Tyler Adams in the midfield than anybody else in the pool. The way he tracks down the ball and wins the ball, it's a crazy transformation. I don't so I love that, and I think that puts him, at least in my mind, right in the top four midfielders for the U.S. men's national team, but probably behind, well, top four, who knows? I in my mind it'd be Adams, McKennie, and then Pomacall, because I guess I'm sort of a radical in that I'm tired of the Bradley Trapp thing. But so I put him right up there in any case. I don't think he's so he takes too many touches sometimes, and I don't think his passing, like you alluded to, his passing is rarely surprising or defense opening. At least it hasn't been in this tournament. And so I'm not just totally carried away by Paxton Pomacall, but his defensive work and his just general reliability and possession seems like he'd be perfect to be Weston McKennie's backup at the eight, and maybe even slot in as one of the eights next to McKennie right now, all things being equal.
And I think that's the argument, right? Like you and I look at it similarly, where we would rather have a midfield where there's a six, an eight, and a 10. And we're both hoping that it's Ledesma, because I think there are other very good young number 10 prospects in the U.S. pipeline, but I think Ledesma is a level above the rest of them.
I agree.
So I like that balance, but like someone like Bobby Warshaw would say, no, you don't need to have a 10. What you need to do is win the ball in transition quickly. You don't need that individual creativity. You need team structure that allows you to compress the field where you want to, and then you need well-drilled players in that front six to win and play the next pass. And yeah. I mean, he's right to an extent. There are great teams in the world who do not use anything close to a traditional number 10, or have, you know, a midfield balance where the say a 4-3-3, like the six is the six, but the two guys in front of them do the exact same thing. There's not one who is more attacking than the other. And if that's what the next phase is for the U.S., I mean, I'm fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's be miserable to play against through central midfield. Let's win the ball and just get it as quickly as possible to Pulisic on one wing and Weah on the other, and whether it's Josie or Sargent up top, that sounds fantastic to me, because I'm tired of seeing us look slow and soft through central midfield.
Boy, do I agree with that, man. Having watched that friendly on Thursday, or was it Wednesday, against Jamaica, and just get overrun by some of the opponents were USL players, and we're just getting absolutely outclassed athletically. I'm just tired of that bullshit. Like, give me an athletic, ball-winning, challenging midfield, and then we can sort of go from there. I'm really sympathetic with Bobby on that right now. Maybe once we get a little more solidity and sort things out a little bit, I'll be back in the sort of give me a creative 10 in one of those spots. But,
mm-hmm. And I think it comes, if our midfield is Adams as the six, and then either McKennie or Pomacall as the eight, then you could end up carrying a 10 like Ledesma, who's not a great defensive player, but I think he's going to end up being a pretty good defensive player from that position. Yeah. And then you not only have defensive balance, and you not only have hopefully structure, but you also have that little touch of brilliance and creativity in that role that Pomacall doesn't necessarily bring. Oh, and by the way, you push Pulisic out wide into his more natural position, and that's a team that can do some damage.
Absolutely.
But we are projecting out a couple of years right now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Well, it's the midfield you're describing is a little bit like a Cervenia, Pomacall, Mendez midfield, where you have Cervenia mm-hmm. in the Adams role.
Yep.
Which, to come back to that, is probably the biggest mistake that Tab made in this game, playing Durkin over Cervenia.
I think so. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, you go ahead, and then I'll talk about a couple more players that I'm excited about. But you go ahead.
I understand why Tab did it, because in theory, Durkin is a guy who brings that rhythm and that tempo and that calmness to possession. And this is a team that, I mean, if you have Mendez out there, then you're kind of married to the idea that you're only going to create chances out of possession. And so it was about trying to take something that we were going to have to do, doing it as well as possible. But Durkin's not there yet. And Cervenia is just a little bit more robust physically. He's better at winning the ball. He showed it against France. I'm not going to say that it lost us the game, but it didn't put us in as good a position as we needed to be to win the game against a team this good.
Yeah. Yeah, we may have lost anyway. And speaking of Cervenia, I don't see him as a, like, necessarily a guy who's ever going to play for the national team. He just happened to be the right guy for this moment in my mind,
Yeah, I think that's right. I actually, this is something that has been discussed ad nauseum on Twitter and other social media. It was a surprise to see Cervenia end up as the second choice defensive midfielder for this team over Cerrillo, when Cerrillo's locked down that job for FC Dallas. And by outplaying Cervenia at the MLS level, it looked really good doing it. But these are, these are the things that happen with different coaches, with young players, with different systems. We weren't there for practice or for the Uruguay scrimmage, so I'm not about to kill Tab for that one. But
Yeah,
Oh, it would have been nice.
yeah. Sounds like Cerrillo didn't play super well in that Uruguay friendly. Can't prove it though. I would say another player who we didn't get to see at all, just like Cerrillo, in this tournament, who has a good chance, I think, of being a national team player, hopefully for the US, but maybe for Mexico, is Julian Araujo. I almost would have liked to see him at center back, in one of these games. I get why Tab didn't want to mess with his center back pairing, especially this late in the tournament. But I can't imagine Araujo would have been any worse than Keita, and probably would have been more comfortable on the ball. I mean, you just look at the basics of their careers. Keita has, I think, under 200 minutes in USL League One, which is Division Three, third division of American soccer. And Julian Araujo's been a starter for the LA Galaxy on three occasions. Granted, at right back
Yeah.
or right wing back, but he can play center back. And I think he's a very, very big prospect. And too bad we didn't get to see him in this tournament. Somewhat understandable. Dest was immense in the last two games, in my opinion. But
Yep.
I'll be
I
watching
don't
his
disagree with
career.
that. Yeah, Araujo is an A-plus prospect. He is from what I understand, someone that we're going to have to work hard to keep. Because Mexico are there and scouting him, and Mexico certainly showed that they could use a talent infusion in this age cohort, and he would help them a lot. Worth remembering, he's the youngest player on this team. He's just 17, doesn't turn 18 until I believe mid-August, so he can be back for the next one if we're able to keep him. Ochoa can be back. De La Fuente can be back, and Ulián Yanez can be back as well. Hopefully those guys, I mean, that's a nice core right there for the next group. And then you add a bunch of those 17s and maybe a kid like Thomas Roberts, who's about to start right now for FC Dallas today. There's a lot to look forward to with this group. Let me ask you about Dest, because I saw him play maybe four times this spring between the U19s streams that you mostly found, I think it was, and
Daniel Smith, probably. Daniel Smith. He's digging
yeah,
those
probably
up.
Daniel. Yeah, and between the U19s and the Dutch second tier, the Eredivisie, he struggles anytime he has to defend against direct play, and we saw that in the group stage, and like it just. It wasn't just getting, smaller kid getting physically overpowered. It was his footwork is wrong. He doesn't seem to understand angles and how to attack the ball. It was really bad against Ukraine, and it was bad again against Nigeria. But he did bounce back in these two games. Did you think that was a product of him just being better in the knockout rounds, or was it he didn't have to face the same type of attacks? From like France and Ecuador both kept the ball on the ground. They weren't playing long balls, long diagonals, anything like that. Was it a combination of the two things, you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, the thing that he struggled with is like dealing with the ball in the air. Is that's what you mean by a direct play, essentially?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So when he's squaring somebody up 1v1, he was, I thought, magnificent in both these last two games and defending that. I suppose it's a combination of the two. He's possibly came into the tournament feeling a little bit overconfident or something, and then we all got punched in the mouth by Ukraine, who has already punched their tickets to the semifinals. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think his defending at Young Ajax has been so bad. I think he had a couple bad games, but has had a lot of good games too. I'll have to. That's a very long way to say I don't know the answer to the question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where he might be the type of player where if he's in the system where you're going to have 60% of the ball, he might be amazing. He might be, the best player on the team going forward. But if he's going to be defending a lot, and that makes it tough that he's at Ajax. I almost wish he was at a lesser
Nakbreda.
Dutch club. Yeah, well, not knock. They were terrible. But somebody, you know,
just throw them right into the fire.
All right. But like somebody who's not going to have 65% possession. And I guess the bigger picture is he an IX player? Is this a kid, and he's 18, 19 years old now, and this, we know that at IX, this is the age at which they start matriculating you to the first team if they think you're good enough. Do you think we will see him play for Ajax in the coming season?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, Ajax is a team that could have easily won the Champions League this year, and it's hard to see.
Bells, they sold. They're going to sell half their team this summer, so there's going to be minutes to go around.
Are they? Are they going to sell? I mean, I know they're selling a lot of guys, but are they selling any of their right backs? I haven't checked lately.
I thought the right back, I know Tagliafico, the left back, isn't going to be sold, but I thought the right back was. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah. I mean, I knew there were rumors. Is Mazraoui, is his name, was going to be sold, mm-hmm. but I haven't been keeping track. And then they had a guy who was the captain the year before, whose name escapes me, who was injured most of the season, who's now healthy again, who plays right back. I'd be surprised if he's getting first team minutes next year, but what do I know? I'm just a guy in the Midwest. So I guess, you say this a lot, so maybe this is a good point to close on. Like, the big question for all these guys, just as it is with Dest, is what's going to happen with their clubs over the next few months? Are you anything in particular you're looking for or looking at heading into the fall?
I mean, the big ones are Gloucester and Ledesma to me, because they're good players at positions of need for us. And I hope against hope that both of those guys end up in situations where they can play. It's going to be tough for Ledesma. He's, playing for PSV, which is one of the great clubs in Europe and thus the world. But they already took the plunge with him.
Yeah.
Dutch teams can't sign foreigners on the cheap. It's not like, Yanez or Mendes making $12,000 a year in Germany. They're paying Mendes or Ledesma rather $225,000 a year. And then if they matriculate him up to the first team, it ends up being, I think, $450.
Yeah. It just went up. Yeah.
Yeah. And so And they have to decide within the year, I think it is. By this time next year, if he hasn't made it, then they have to move him on. So the fact that they've taken that leap with him tells me that they think pretty highly of him already. So I have high hopes for that. I have high hopes for Gloucester. Like I said, I would much rather see him get 2,000 minutes in the two Bundesliga than see him, get 200 minutes in the actual Bundesliga.
Yeah.
Those are the two big ones because of where we are as a player pool. And then I think even bigger than that is the guy who wasn't here, Josh Sargent. Josh Sargent played 200 minutes this year after signing. He signed with Werder Bremen over Bayern Munich specifically because Bremen had a plan to get him into the first team ASAP and to give him real minutes, and that plan didn't really come through. And now he's had kind of a wasted year and a wasted summer that hopefully he'll use to get as fit as he possibly can and get to that team next month. I think their preseason starts on July 7th. Get to that team in a month and just kick ass. Because we need a young forward, we need a young 10, and we need a young left back. That, like, if you tossed out every other player from this group, but you gave me those three guys, I would take it.
Mm-hmm. I'd really like to have another right back too. Like, assuming Berhalter doesn't stick with this system, for the rest of his tenure as coach, which maybe he will. But if things start to change up a little bit, it sure would be nice to have Sergiño Dest or Julian Araujo emerge as a an every week starter in some professional league. and push their way into the national team, because I don't think DeAndre Yedlin's that good. I don't think Nick Lima's that good either, and we need something better over there.
For what it's worth, I think Araujo has a real chance to be that guy for the Galaxy. It would not surprise me if he came back from this tournament and was a full-time starter for the LA Galaxy. I think that McKenzie has a chance, you know, as he gets his fitness up, to win his job back for Philadelphia, though he's going to have to compete for it, especially because that team's been really good this year. And Pomacall will walk right back in the starting lineup for FC Dallas. The interesting thing is going to be Cerrillo and Cervania to see if, okay, they end up going head-to-head now, because they're coming back to a Dallas team that's without Brian Acosta, who's at the Gold Cup, and without Carlos Grezo, who's at Copa America.
Yeah.
So there's a chance for them to, you know, either form a partnership or renew their, their sort of preseason competition that Surreal won. So that, you know, that has a chance to be really fun as well. And I think this is the bigger, better long-term picture that we've all been kind of waiting for. This is the first group that's really post Bradenton.
Yeah.
This is the one where there were no college kids, where pretty much everyone came through either, you know, Ajax or Barcelona, or like a USSDA top clubs, or an the vast majority of them in MLS academy,
yeah,
a professional academy. And even compared to 2 years ago, and especially compared to 4 years ago, I thought the level of play was higher. I thought that the level of individual technical skill was higher.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought for the guys who were already pros, Pomacall especially, the level of on-field problem-solving and savvy was much higher than in the past. And I think that speaks to what the future is for the U.S. program. We've gone from, in 2013, we were taking, you know, any kid we could find in a Mexican academy and a couple of best, college players. In 2015, it was a better mix of, you know, a Miazga or a Carter Vickers and, you know, Kellen Acosta, guys who were, you know, a few of them were produced by actual academies. And that got scaled up in 2017 until this year. This felt like the team that was a product of an integrated and intentional developmental system, as opposed to a team that was just a collection of mismatched parts that had been tried to sort of knit it together, mostly via Bradenton and the younger levels.
Mm-hmm.
It is good for us as a soccer country, as a soccer culture, to have moved beyond that. I think that you could say that in a lot of ways, the players that we've had develop in the past developed in spite of our developmental program here. And it felt like this is a group that developed and made it to the quarterfinals of the U20 World Cup because of what we've put in place here. And that, more than anything else, more than beating France, more than, you know, balling out versus Nigeria, more than anything else, that's what has me confident, not just hopeful, but actually confident for the groups to come. Mm-hmm. And now we just need it to translate. Now we just need it to translate at the club level, because for every one of these kids, it doesn't matter how good you were at the Youth World Cup. If you're not getting professional minutes, you're not going to make a difference for the U.S. national team.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could play with anybody in this tournament. I mean, we didn't – we're not going to dominate France, but we could play soccer with anybody with this collection of players. I do think it'll be the next step, maybe the next near-term step, is maybe for Rafael Wicki to take over the U20s and for the sort of the system to be truly integrated from top to bottom, which is something it kind of hasn't been lately. That'll be a welcome change, just from a structural perspective. Not that I'm not making any comment on Wicki versus Tab Ramos, just structurally to have it all be one thing. I think that'll be great, and it'll feed players into the senior team who are already ready, you know, are already familiar with the system, hopefully, and can just be slotted in, which I think creates a lot of efficiency, needless to say.
Yeah, I do think that would be a big step, and I really liked what I saw, Vicky, with those U17s, because they were abysmal in that first game of the tournament, and by the end of the tournament, they were playing some of the best soccer at that level that I think I've ever seen the U.S. play.
Yeah.
And so hopefully we get to see him take over the U20s, because, you know, Tab Ramos has had a good 7-year run at this point, and you know, he's going to step aside, and we'll see what the future holds for him. And Vicky does seem like the sort of natural successor.
All right, U17 World Cup in October, I believe, and lots of MLS action up until then. If you don't already, you should read what Matt Doyle writes. He writes a lot of good stuff about the national team. He writes a great weekly recap of all the MLS action. Thanks, Matt, for joining me. Appreciate it. Under these sad circumstances, bittersweet, as you said. Bittersweet.
Yeah. Bittersweet circumstances. It's nice to make the quarterfinals of the Youth World Cup again. It was good to chat with you, Bell.
Yeah. Thanks, man. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you.